So would you introduce yourself, please?
This is Juliana Hatfield.
So we're not going to talk music yet. I want to talk about Boston University because I made it through there alive. So now, I was born in 57. We don't talk about a woman's age, but you were born...
I was born in the summer of love. Since, you know, I'm... Well, let's just say I was born in the summer of love.
That works. Everybody understands that.
Yeah.
I want to frame what we're going to talk about because growing up in Boston... So when did you, what did you start to study at BU before you switched over to Berkeley?
Well, I was studying a liberal arts curriculum. It was, I was taking an advanced French and a writing class, a composition class, and stuff like that, you know, quote unquote liberal arts.
Right, and you realized at some very, very early moment that that was not what you were going to be doing.
Yeah, I went to BU because I thought I was playing it safe. I thought I should, you know, my father wanted me to go to college, and I went to BU because I figured I would get an all-around education. But I really just wanted to play in a band, and I couldn't find anyone to play in a band with at BU, and so I had to leave. I had to get out.
All the Jewish American princesses from New York just weren't up for playing rock and roll.
I felt like such an oddball at BU. I wasn't happy there.
Now, did you commute or live in those dorms on Comm Ave?
I lived in one of those three big
The towers right on Comm Ave, which was over a store 24 back in the day.
They overlooked a football field.
Oh, okay, so you were West Campus, yep. near the pizza place.
Yeah, yeah.
Got it.
TNT's.
Isn't this a word? Everybody's going to listen to an interview, they're like, oh, they're just reminiscing about...
The Paradise.
Yeah, I know exactly, yeah. Right, near the football field, yeah, and all the rah-rahs and all the big guys walking around in football uniforms and bleh.
Yeah.
Yeah, I understand. Now, you must have seen bands at the Rat. What was your favorite band you saw at the Rat? That kind of made you say, especially when you were younger, that you said, okay, I want to do this.
My favorite band, I don't know. I think I saw Sonic Youth there with Jay Maskus playing guitar with them. And at the time, no one knew who Jay Maskus was. And he was just, there was just this long-haired kid playing this amazing guitar with Sonic Youth. And everyone was like, who is that guy? And then he formed Dinosaur and he became... My favorite guitar player. Actually, I think Dinosaur had already formed at that time.
While Berkeley is famous for jazz, there are so many rock musicians that have emerged from there.
From Berkeley?
Yeah.
I know. So many people that I encounter in the world of music on the road have at least passed through Berkeley. I think it's just, it's known as a jazz school, you know, but a lot of people that are there are sort of suffering through the jazz studies, and they really just want to rock.
Yeah, exactly.
You know? Exactly. There are a lot of jazz people, but there's a kind of rivalry between the jazzers and the rockers.
A little West Side Story moment.
Yeah, like the jazz people kind of look down at the rockers, and the rockers thought the jazz people were elitist snobs. Yeah, there was definitely some snobbery. The Blake Babies used to practice. My first band, the Blake Babies, used to practice in the rehearsal rooms at Berkeley, and each rehearsal room had a little window, and people would walk by and they'd look in and they'd laugh at us, the jazz people, because I didn't really know how to play guitar at that point, and they thought we were kind of ridiculous.
The thing about the Blake Babies that it's funny because I mentioned to somebody that I was interviewing you as somebody who's a pretty good music person, and they said, well, here's the interesting thing about the band, and I think the band was completely, I don't want to say out of time, but you know, if you look at that moment where a band could come into play, right, you know, of the 60s, and then, you know, power pop, which kind of hit at a certain time, and then where we are today, you know, and I'm not saying you formed the band at the wrong time, but what's interesting to me is that someone said to me, didn't they do a cover of Temptation Eyes?
I kind of think that my whole career, the timing has been kind of off with everything. I still have hope that it's going to line up.
I've heard
someday.
You say that, and I respectfully disagree, which I hope that gives you hope, because my feeling is that, you know, you make your own time on things, you know.
Yeah.
And we'll get into all the things that have happened, not all the deep dark soap opera things, because those have been written up and portrayed so well in other interviews.
Well, you know, I feel like the Blake Babies didn't really fit in to any musical scene that was happening. But then again, there wasn't really a Boston sound, I don't think, when the Blake Babies were happening. I mean, maybe a few years before there was more of a kind of scuzzy rock and roll sound. But when the Blake Babies started, it was like Blake Babies, who else? Like Dinosaur, Throwing Muses, Pixies, you know, stuff that didn't really, there was not really any unifying musical theme or sound.
No, at that time there wasn't. You know, yeah. in the early 80s there was.
Yeah.
With Mission
kind
of Burma.
A little before my time.
Yeah, there was. And then, you know, and then the Mighty Mighty Boss Tones, you know, kind of came in at another area.
Yeah.
So it's, but what's interesting to me is growing up in, and I know how to say it, Duxbury. Most people would be like, Duxbury.
Duxbury.
But
Duxbury.
It's Duxbury. But I'll bet you couldn't wait to get out of all of that and head for Alston or head for other places.
Yeah, I was ready to go and, you know, start my band, and that definitely wasn't going to happen in Duxbury. I couldn't find anyone who liked the Replacements in my town. You know, I had to listen to them by myself, and, you know, I couldn't share my love for the Replacements with anyone because people were listening to, like, I don't know, like Journey and you know, Pat Benatar, which is, I was too loving Journey and Pat Benatar, but also I was loving X and the Replacements, and I needed to go to the city to find people like me.
And so now this brings me up, and we're going to go completely out of order from the norm, but it brings me to, then I thought, well, you know, here she is, she comes from Duxbury, and then she named her record company Ye Old Records.
Yeah.
which is so New England.
Well, you know, it's just kind of a jokey name. You know, it's kind of ironic because record, you know, ye old, there were no records in the olden days. And yeah, but I definitely feel that New England is my home, and I love New England, and the town I grew up in is really pretty. You know, I grew up walking distance from the beach, the Atlantic Ocean, and in a lot of ways it was a great place to grow up just because you know, there was the ocean and no city noises and smells, and it was very kind of pretty. And I feel very tied to New England. I love a lot of things about it. I love the history and the weather and the changing of the leaves. So, yeah, there's a part of me that's kind of old-fashioned and simple, and I like the simple things in life. But
it was all by the sea and the ocean, and that informs kind of a different life than people who, say, live in Nebraska and are
definitely
not near the water at
definitely.
All.
Definitely. The beach was just such a huge part of my life growing up, and it was such a part of the whole culture of being a kid. You just, that's when, in the summertime, you rode your bike to the beach, and when you were a teenager, you went to the beach, and you hung out and drank beer in the parking lot, and it was all about the beach and the ocean. And now I feel that I couldn't live anywhere that's not near a coast, because I feel really claustrophobic if I'm not near an ocean.
So the book, the infamous book,
mm-hmm.
People can read the book. We don't need to go over the chapters in the book.
Right.
But one of the things that was interesting is that everybody's writing it up as your memoir. Now, don't you write a memoir when you're, I mean, am I wrong that you generally write your memoir when
you're
like,
older.
When you're older and you're pretty much so... That they, well, take me between the lines a little bit.
Well, the things that I left out, I left them out on purpose because I wanted to keep them for myself. I mean, that's what the book ultimately did for me. It helped me to put everything I've done so far into perspective and to be able to move on from there. But I wasn't consciously trying to do that. I think I was just... It's like when I write music, it's very unconscious. I don't have a concept and I don't have a plan. I just sort of sit down and I lose myself and things come out of me, and that's sort of what happened with the book.
In another interview recently, you called music the one thing that has always taken you through the ups and downs of life. What do you think accountants and lawyers have?
I don't know. I think a lot of accountants are math geniuses, and they have a passion for math. And so they probably love their job just as much as I love making music.
Would we be better off if we were more reliable and were accountants instead of being in this insane business?
I don't know. You know, I think everyone has a role to play, and I have a lot of admiration for certain accountants that I've known, because I could never do what they do. I'm in awe of what they can do with numbers.
What do you think the difference is between those in this lovely business who survive, you know, and those, and I'm not talking about drugs, because drugs, mm-hmm. drugs is over here to me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there are people that, that go down that path and they don't make it.
Right.
And that's just the way it is.
Right.
But what do you think about those who are still alive? And this can be you, this can be Evan, this can be any of the people that you know well.
That's a really good question. I don't know. I think it's just a crazy kind of determination. I don't know what I, you know, I talk about that in the book. I talk about how I don't understand how people quit music or they change careers once they've put out a record and it's not successful. And I think, oh, okay, I'm going to move on to something else. But for me, I guess what drives me is not, I'm not driven by a need for fame or money. I'm driven by some weird compulsion to create music, and it's just, it doesn't really make any sense. That's what keeps me going. I feel like I haven't made all the music that I need to make. I know that's kind of a boring answer.
No, it's a legitimate answer, because you have to have something that, when you wake up in the morning, you have to have some purpose, and it doesn't matter what you do for a living, but in rock and roll, you know, and again, your tale, for better or for worse, of, you know, record labels and all of that, it hasn't changed for anybody.
I feel like I was lucky because my record companies never really tried to impose anything on me. I really was able to, they let me make the records I wanted to make, and they let me work with the producers I wanted to work with, and they really left me alone. So I feel that I've kind of been doing the same thing forever. I've been working the same way, and no one ever pressured me to do anything that felt weird to me. And maybe that's why I'm able to continue, is because I never really felt that I had to compromise. I've never compromised my music.
Maybe they felt that you had enough talent that they didn't have to, you know.
Well, originally they did. But then, you know, my talent didn't pay off in a big way.
Andy Chase produced the album, and it's well told that he pushed you to do new things on the album in terms of your voice and all of that.
Yeah.
But tell me something else about the sessions that you think made the record what it was.
Well, Andy and I were just so completely in tune with each other. Every other recording session I've had with a producer, there came a point where the producer and me butted heads, but it never happened with Andy. I trusted him more than I've ever trusted any producer, and I put it all in his hands, and we agreed on everything. So, but there's a story that I like to tell about making the record. It was so great working with Andy, and that we discovered this bottle of whiskey in the studio. It was called Basil something.
Basil Hayden.
And we cracked it open one night. Neither of us had ever heard of this brand of whiskey, and we drank some, and we both just thought it was the most amazing, delicious whiskey ever. And so it became a ritual. At the end of every night, we would have a drink of Basil Hayden. And then when the record was finished and I went home to Boston, Andy and I both, on our own, bought bottles of Basil Hayden for ourselves just to have at home, and I took a drink at home and it didn't taste good, and Andy had the same experience. He tried to drink Basil Hayden at home and it didn't taste the same to him either, and we were thinking, was there something wrong with the latest batch of Basil Hayden or something? But I think that the recording sessions were so great and so wonderful that the whiskey tasted better.
The mix of people that you chose to sing with, you choose a new wave, or whatever you want to call it, icon in Richard Butler.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I've had many moments seeing the Psych Furs and saying, okay, I still don't get that band, but it doesn't really matter.
Uh-huh.
And then you pick, you know, Matthew Cause, who actually, Not a Surf, has been on the show twice, and I love that band passionately.
Me too.
I think they're divine.
Yeah.
You know, you're not effing around here. You know what you're doing.
Yeah, I think it's very cohesive. It's an album, you know. It's not a couple singles and a bunch of filler.
But you, but when you chose, I mean, This Lonely Love, that's a hit.
You think so?
No, I know so.
That's what Andy says. There are moments when I just feel a little bit discouraged, but I mean, I've been doing it for 20 years and I can keep going. You know, I'm not going to quit after all this time.
In another interview, you mentioned that you long for Fleetwood Mac, Eagles, Olivia Newton-John, the 70s, and
yes,
all of that. Does that, do you think that would scare your target audience if they really knew that?
No, I think you can hear it in my music sometimes. I when I was a kid, I was obsessed with the AM radio of the 70s, and it's in my blood, all of that.
So that was
stuff.
WRKO back
yes,
then?
Yes, yeah.
Dale Dorman and all
yeah,
those guys, yep.
Yeah, and it, you can hear it in my music, you know, and then I discovered punk rock, and you can hear that in my music too, and it's all in there. And there's nothing to be ashamed about. I love Bread, I love Heart, I love England Dan and John Ford Coley.
So I have invented a little thing, we've done it with over 200 artists, called a musical sandwich.
Mm-hmm.
And it's two of your songs as the bread,
mm-hmm,
and then a bunch of other songs that you're just going to riff for a couple of minutes in between, and I will play exactly what you ask. And now you know I won't be scared of anything,
mm-hmm,
you know, anything you ask me to play. But it's my way of getting people into this record,
mm-hmm,
and then letting them know what was in your brain.